Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Cost of Employment edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as always, by Slate's Moneybox columnist, Jordan Weissman.
Hello, Felix.
Hello, Jordan. And Kathy O'Neill is in Atlanta. And so standing in for Kathy, we have the insanely amazing and awesome Ellie Mistel, the editor of Above the Law.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Above the Law is, quick plug,
a legal blog that focuses on the fun part of law.
It's hilarious. If you never thought that law could be funny, just check it out. It's fantastic. And we will be talking about the profession of the law and why Ellie's not in it.
Why I'm recovering.
A little bit still. Later. And we'll also be talking about student loans, because we love the topic of student loans. Here's today's question. Is it ever a good idea to just simply default on your student loans? We will ask Ellie. He has first-person experience of this. But first, we're going to talk about a different kind of quitting. We're going to talk about CEOs losing their job, and one CEO in particular. It was, this week, a big news week. It was a big news week for CEOs losing their jobs. We had the co-CEOs of Deutsche Bank, Anshu Jain and Jürgen Fitschen. They were fired by the board. Jain is out already. Fitschen will be out soon. And they're going to be replaced by this guy, John Cryer, who has the advantage, unlike Jain, that he speaks German. This is useful, apparently, it turns out, when you
work at Deutsche Bank.
You have the CEO of Showtime, Matthew Blank. He's been there for a very long time. He said that he's retiring. His deputy, David Nevins, is taking over. What we see here is, like, when you quit, you have someone to replace you. When the board fires you, there's a succession plan in place. What we had Rupert Murdoch. We all love Rupert Murdoch. He has a couple of CEO jobs, but the bigger one, the CEO of 21st Century Fox, he said he was going to resign from that and hand over to his son, James Murdoch. It's, you know, we all know that Rupert's still going to actually be in charge, but the point being that there's a succession plan. And, of course, the most chaotic company in the world, where nothing can ever go right and they have no idea how to manage their way out of a paper bag. At Twitter, the board went and fired Dick Costolo and had no idea what to do. And they said, oh, we fired you. And don't know what to do. So let's put Jack Dorsey in as an interim CEO. You know, despite the fact that he actually has a day job as CEO of this other company called Square.
A not insignificant company, mind you. How many CEOs are, like, or how many CEOs are there out there who are running two disparate large companies right
now? So the only thing I could think of was Steve Jobs at Apple and Pixar.
Yeah, I guess that's, but like currently, besides Steve Jobs, who's sort of Superman.
Doesn't Twitter really run itself, though?
it's all algorithmic, which might explain why it's been having so many troubles. But Jack Dorsey, just for anyone who doesn't, for some reason, listener doesn't remember the name, he is a co-founder of Twitter, who sort of got...
And a former CEO.
And a former CEO.
Who was basically fired himself and replaced by Dick Costolo, because Dick Costolo was considered to be more of a grown-up who could manage. But it turns out that most of Dick Costolo's senior management ranks have seen massive turnover. Everyone's coming in and out. And, of course, lethally for the CEO of any public company, Dick Costolo was the guy who took Twitter public. and then proceeded to see its share price go in the wrong direction, that is down rather than up. And when you're the CEO of a company whose share price is going down, your job is never that safe.
So think about this, that the thing about what's going on at Twitter, I think, is kind of interesting from a broader perspective, besides just the chaos, is it really forces the question of the issue of their sort of identity crisis, right? Twitter has not figured out how to meet Wall Street's expectations yet. They're having slower revenue growth, slower user growth than they thought, and they don't really know how to maintain the service as a lot of people have come to know and love it, while expanding its reach.
And the expectations...
Is that really Twitter's fault, though? I mean, one of the things that I think is always funny about Twitter is that, to me, it's the investors that were the dumbasses for investing in it in the first place, right? Like, if the problem that Costolo has is that he can't figure out how to make money off Twitter at its fundamental level. Nobody can figure out how to make money off of Twitter at a fundamental level. Anybody who looks at Twitter would look at it and say, I don't really know how to make money off of that. Now, when you bring in somebody who says, I can magically make money off of that, and it doesn't work, who's the dumbass? The guy who promised that they could make money off of it without an idea, or the people who believe that guy?
Okay, so the first thing is that Twitter was actually quite careful not to say that they were going to make money. It is interesting.
But they got the valuation as if they were going to make money.
Well, no, that's actually no. I mean, I'm going to come to that in a minute. But the when they went public, they were quite careful to say that they didn't plan to have massive profits anytime soon. And in fact, they have completely delivered on that lack of a profit, on that promise, and they have not made any money, and they're still losing well over $100 million per quarter. Yeah. We're talking half a billion dollars per year in losses, which you can't sustain, except for, interestingly, they're not cash losses. They're mostly related to stock-based compensation. They pay all of their staff in stock. So under generally accepted accounting principles, that shows up as a, you know, nine-figure loss. But, of course, the staff isn't very happy if you're being paid in stock and the stock is going down.
Yes.
So that makes demoralized staff, and that's not good. So your question, Ellie, is, you know, shouldn't we just be blaming the investors for putting such a high valuation on this thing? Your point, Jordan, was that Twitter failed to meet Wall Street's expectations. And the answer to both of these questions is, well, Twitter kind of worked this out. And they hired Anthony Noto from Goldman Sachs to be their chief financial officer, precisely because it is the job of any public company. It is one of the key jobs of any public company is this thing called expectations management. You don't allow your investors to start running away with crazy expectations, because that is a recipe for doom when those expectations aren't met. And so when Noto came in, everyone was like, okay, now we're going to have some common sense here and he's going to be able to manage the expectations better. He didn't. You know, when the last quarterly earnings came out, everyone was disappointed because, again, when Twitter went public, they said the thing that they really were promising. They weren't promising profits, but they were promising user growth.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly changed their mind because the user growth failed to appear. So now they've tried to come up with a whole bunch of other metrics which they can deliver on. But it's a mess.
So you're saying that this Noto guy is the guy who should have been fired?
Well, Noto hasn't been there that long.
Because I think Jordan's point is that, like, there needs to be heads on the table, right?
Well, there's been a lot of people who've been fired, up to and including the CEO. It's not clear that Twitter's problems are problems which can be solved by firing people. And Chris Sacker, one of Twitter's big investors, just wrote an 8,500-word blog post going on and on and on about all the different things which Twitter can and should be doing. But not one of those was, let's just fire everyone, because that doesn't really help.
Well, so let's talk about what Twitter should be doing. I mean, at this, you know, it seems like what everyone is saying is it needs to kind of transform what it is as a service. It can't be old Twitter anymore and expect to make money. I have trouble.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's true. I mean, if you just keep Twitter exactly as it is and fire everyone, you know, it's got enormous revenues. It just has lots of expenses to go across, you know, with them. If it doesn't try and grow, if it doesn't try and do anything, if it just sort of like says, well, maybe Periscope is going to make us money, then presumably it could cut its R&D costs, which are huge, enormously, and then it would make money.
So they could just go on autopilot and stop trying to be a growth stock in any way, or stop being a growth company.
The reason why people don't like Twitter, though, and the reason why that doesn't work is that you have to grow in this world. Like, in a world where they've already been overtaken by Instagram, they're probably going to get overtaken by Snapchat pretty soon. And there's any number of other sort of social networks which are, you know, going to be formed and might well overtake them. This is a world, weirdly, where 300 million active monthly users is not that many.
Yeah, it's funny. Because
you have to grow, otherwise you just get left behind.
Yeah, it's funny because it gets accused of being kind of a collection of small clicks online. I mean, that's the main reason one of the main reasons people cite for why it's difficult to just join Twitter and start using it. It's not as easy as Facebook, where you just find your friends, people you know, and then look at their baby pictures. Twitter, you kind of have to find your tribe and then follow those people and get into conversations with them. But yeah, it's a 300 million strong collection of tribes, which, I mean, after a point, how do you keep growing those how do you keep growing a collection of small villages like that, though?
After a point, doesn't it just become an exit play then? At what point is it just, do you just pare the company down so you can sell it off to somebody who can?
And this is one of the conspiracy theories about this whole concept of the interim CEO, is that, in fact, they're not going to hire a permanent CEO, and in fact, they're just going to sell the company. The rumored acquirer for a long time now has been Google. Personally, I think it would make probably more sense to be bought by Apple for various reasons. But the acquirer which really makes sense to me, to Jordan's point, is Facebook. Because the reason why people don't like or get Twitter is because when you sign up for Twitter, you wind up following Kanye West and a bunch of celebrities and Rihanna and Azalea Banks. I don't know. And I have no idea. Millions of followers.
I just thought that those are the first thing that came to you. Yeah. Like Rihanna, Azalea Banks, the next. Anyway, continue.
And they, no one, that is not interesting, frankly. Yeah. Following a bunch of celebrities and a bunch of brands is not interesting. When Twitter gets interesting is you start following the people you know and you start having conversations with them. And all Facebook would need to do if it bought Twitter is just say, okay, now you can follow all of your friends on Facebook. And that would solve a huge number of problems at one stroke.
First of all, I'm gonna ride or die with Riri's Twitter account. That thing's interesting. No. Secondly, I from a legal perspective, the Facebook angle I hadn't thought of. I'm worried about the Google angle, and I know that we don't have antitrust laws when it comes to what company can control, how much can one company control of my life, right? But at the point where Google and Twitter merge, which is the big rumor, you've got one organization, Google, that knows, that then gets to know what I think before I think it, right?
Yeah.
which from a privacy perspective, from a serious legal perspective, from a privacy perspective, that does worry me. From a kind of conspiracy theorist legal perspective, it's terrifying.
So actually, no, I was thinking very similarly just now. What would happen? I mean, what would an antitrust lawyer think if they looked at Facebook acquiring Twitter? And the problem is defining the market, right? What market would they be taking over? Is it the social media market, in which case that's very diffuse and hard to pin down exactly what it is. But if maybe it's the mobile ad market, in which case they're probably still
they're still much smaller than Google.
Yes, or mobile ad, or maybe display ad. Then, in which case they're not. But it is a question of what are they launching their takeover of at that point?
And then the people who answer that question are going to be Instagram's lawyers, right?
Well, exactly. If you can buy Instagram and if you can buy WhatsApp, then you can buy Twitter. But as for Google, which I think also would have no antitrust problems, here's an interesting little tweak to the conspiracy theory. Dick Costolo has already sold a company to Google. He was the CEO and founder of Feedburner.
Oh, I remember that.
As we know, Google bought Feedburner, created Google Reader. It was wonderful. And then Google killed Google Reader and we all cried. And it was the worst day in the history of the internet. And maybe Dick Costolo, for that reason, just would never sell to Google, and maybe this is going to make it easier for Twitter to sell to Google.
That's a good conspiracy theory.
Okay, enough on Twitter. We are going to move on. Ellie, you posted last week a really fascinating essay about the economics of quitting big law. You used to be one of those lawyers toiling away at, what was it, Debevoise and Plimpton?
It was Debevoise and Plimpton, which I always say is a very nice firm if you like that kind of thing. but I put in my 2.5 years in
and
big
you
law.
Did not like that kind of
that
thing.
It was not for me.
And then you decided to quit. And that had enormous consequences.
It turns out it had enormous economic consequences. So last week was my 10-year anniversary of quitting. You know, when I got out of law school, my starting salary at Debevoise, this is back in 2003, was $145,000 a year, which is more than not only much, obviously the most I had made. It was the most money that anybody in my family had ever made up to that point in a single year. I felt like at some level I owed it to my family to try to like it, right? but I didn't, and I'm selfish like that. So after 2.5 years, I decided to leave the highest paying job that legitimately I'll probably ever have.
But those illegitimate ones are so much more fun.
to start on the path that has led me to writing essays online about how much money I used to make. and so I calculated it out, and it turns out pre-tax, if you just take all the salary and bonuses that I would have made over the past 10 years, and you have to do some creative accounting to kind of come up with a figure, minus the money that I've made writing online, I used to teach for Kaplan, you know, whatever I have to do in the alley to make ends meet, I left approximately $2,273,500 on the table over the past 10 years.
$2.2 million?
Yep. Which is a lot.
It's a lot of money.
So how does that make you feel?
You know, at first it made me sick to my stomach, and it also made my wife very, very sad. But eventually,
because she was like, I could do with that money.
Yeah. Because, you know, somebody still has to pay our bills, and right now that's my wife who didn't, you know, she also is a lawyer, and she didn't leave the job, and now she works at an investment bank being a lawyer. So she's had to kind of stay in it while I've gotten out. So, you know, she's a nice woman. How did it make me feel ultimately? It made me feel ultimately like it was worth every penny, right? Right. Like I said in my article, you can't put a price on happiness. Apparently I can. $2.2 million is how much my happiness is worth to me. But I think the reason why I did it is to, you know, there's so many online articles, there's so many career advisors who talk about work-life balance, and I want to kind of look at, well, what does that actually cost? My lifestyle is great now compared to what it was, but there is a real economic cost that I've paid for it.
Yeah, I really liked your piece and because of the way it nodded to this bigger debate we've seen in the last years about, you know, the economic value of a law degree and how is it worth it to go to law school and such. And you and I, we've argued on the internet before about this subject, and I don't want to jump too deep into the weeds about it. But basically, over the last couple of years, there's been this one professor in particular named Mike Simkovic and a colleague of his named Frank McIntyre who've done some, I think, very good analysis on the expected return on a law degree. And they say, you know, if you go at the 25th percentile, you can expect to make X $100,000 more than if you just went to college. Or at the 50th percentile, you can expect to make, you know, X $100,000 more. But in your piece, you point out something that I think should be very obvious here, which is that making a career in the law is an extremely emotionally draining and difficult and sometimes unpredictable, especially
okay,
now.
Okay, so wait. Explain experience. This to me, because I would be astonished if 75% of people with law degrees made a career in the law. You're saying that at the 25th percentile, you can still expect to make more than if you'd just gone to college.
Yes, but then as you go up the percentiles, when you get to people who really are working in a law firm specifically.
Right, but you're saying that even at the 25th percentile, you still make more. It's still worth it.
Yes, and that's part
he's
of his analysis. Yeah, he's saying that. That's part of his analysis.
What we know about law degrees what we know about earnings after you graduate from law school is that those earnings are what's known as bimodal.
Yeah.
That there's a relatively small number, and Ellie is in this sense quite exceptional, because only like 10% of law graduates actually graduate into one of those $145,000 a year big law jobs.
Exactly. Currently, it's 160.
That's the jackpot. But most law graduates don't go there. And then if you don't get one of those jobs, then the amount of money you make is much lower. And I think that what Ellie's done is he's managed to build a career for himself as someone with a law degree, which, and he uses that law degree every day in his work, it's not like he's, you know, not getting value from that law degree.
No, I'm not saying you don't get value from it. In fact, I tend to, like I said, I think it's good analysis. The problem is, if you look at the number and say, oh, I'll make X amount more if I, you know, I'm bound to make $1 million more in my lifetime or whatnot, it's less certain than that. And there are all sorts of other factors. And a lot of it is just, what kind of work can you really, what kind of work is right for you?
Can you stomach?
There's
one of my problems. I have a lot of problems with this guy's analysis. And one of them is that it doesn't take into account at all kind of a what seems like an intangible question, but really isn't. Are you going to like it? Because if you're not going to like it, if you're not going to love it, if you don't want to be a lawyer, then your chances of actually hanging in through the wars kind of long enough to get that return, to get that money, are vanishingly small. Even if you end up on the top peak of the bimodal distribution, your chances of staying in that top peak for long enough to make the law degree pay off to you are, again, vanishingly small.
Okay, but I have a couple questions for you. I mean, is this not the wrong comparator? Ellie, do you like your job right now?
Yeah.
Ellie, is the reason that you have this job right now entirely a function of the fact that you have a law degree?
No. No, of course not. Of course not. And this is one of the things that I write a lot about online, right? When you look at the law, you also have to look at the opportunity cost, right? So, like, all that time that you're spending, like, going to law school and being a lawyer and whatever, that's time that you're not spending building other skills. So if I hadn't gone to law school at all, no, maybe I wouldn't be an editor at Above the Law writing about law. But I might be an editor at Slate or Fusion or somewhere else writing about white women who try to be black or whatever have you. Like, I would have had 3, 4, 5, 6 years of my life back to build other skills. It's not like if you don't go to law school, that means you're going to sit in on beach on Club Med and serve drinks, right? If you don't go to law school, especially for some of these people that we're talking about, I went to Harvard Law School. You know, a lot of the people that we're talking about are going to some of the best institutions in the world. If you don't do that, you're going to do something else with your life.
And this is also, I have to ask you this, in terms of your calculation, you know, if you hadn't gone to law school, then, you know, in fact, it's kind of worse than you're putting it, because if you hadn't gone to law school, then number one, you would have saved all of the costs of Harvard Law School. But number two, you would have actually made probably a couple hundred thousand dollars at least over those years that you were in law school, and you'd have got a nice little, you know, jumpstart to your career that way.
Doing something, right?
Doing something. Like, so you would, you know, so you regret going to law school.
Yeah, I you know, it's so fashionable, I think, these days to be like, I have no regrets. And of course, man, I regret going. I regret the 13th shot of tequila I took 2 weeks ago. Like, yeah, like things are regretful. So we don't always make the best decisions. We make the best decisions that we can at the time. Looking back on those decisions and saying, like, I have no regrets, that's just not being intelligent, right? Like, of course, if I had to do, and I had the opportunity to do things differently, I'd do things differently. Now, the other aspect of this, and I bring this up as well, is that you can't just remove one domino and then know how the rest would fall. I like where I am in my life now, and I appreciate that at some level, every decision, good or bad, every experience, good or bad, that I've made has in some way led me to being in this position. And so kind of I'll take the whole over the sum of its parts. But yeah, if I could change some parts, you know, I there are lots of things I would have done differently.
So I want to take the conversation a slightly different direction. You're out. You got out. You escaped.
Yes.
You ran away. I can somewhat sympathize. I never went to law school. And the reason I didn't was because I actually spent a lot of time working on the business side of a law firm, thinking maybe I could go into corporate law and make lots of money and be happy. And after a year and a half, I was quite convinced that that would be impossible. So I went back. Thankfully, I saved myself some student loans that way. So I want to take this conversation in a slightly different direction. You know, you escaped. You've gotten out. But
freedom
freedom for my people. Anyway, so the what I'm wondering, you know, you write, you know, Above the Law is sort of the id of the legal industry and the most fun site on the legal industry, and I think probably the most incisive site on the legal industry. How is the industry right now? If someone is considering maybe making a career as a lawyer, is that a crazy thing to do in your perspective at this moment? Like, how, from big law on down?
Right. Okay. So first, there are two basic things that I like to talk about here. One, it's a lottery ticket, right? It's not necessarily a crazy Powerball ticket. It's a scratch off, you know, so you got a chance of getting a return on it, but it's still fundamentally a lottery ticket. You are, when you think about making a career in law, you're playing the odds that you will luck out, both in terms of enjoying and being good at the profession, and B, in terms of being able to find a sustainable career at a price point where you can pay back your loans. So it is a bit of a crapshoot. Two, and I think that this is when I look at the profession as it is now, kind of the post-recession, the post-2009 legal profession, obviously the people who are already in it, who have stuck it out there, they're in kind of the catbird seat right now because there are fewer of them. And, you know, if you were a third-year associate in 2009, now you're a mid-level and there are five of you. So you're in a good way. If you're just thinking about getting in now, it's really a flight to quality. So if you go to the top, you know, U.S. News likes to rank them about the top 14 schools in U.S. News have always been the top 14 since U.S. News started ranking law schools. So we call it the top 14. If you go to one of those top 14 schools, Above the Law has a ranking, we would say the top 15 schools, you're going to be okay. Right? The Harvard grads, the NYU grads, the Columbia grads, the Chicago grads, they're going to be fine. Once you get out of that top tier, however you define it, it's a very challenging market. Especially if you're thinking about, as Felix was talking about, on the bimodal, with the bimodal curve, to punch that top peak of the curve from a non-top 14 school, it's extremely challenging because they're just not hiring. Whereas law firms used to go to their schools that were outside of the top, but like they liked for whatever reason, and pick off that like top 10%, top 5% of the class, they're just not doing it anymore. They're just staying with the traditional powerhouses. So if you're kind of trying to come off the pace, if you're trying to come off the pace right now, you're racing against American Pharoah.
Yeah, that's
all right. So that's a good place to segue, I think, actually, Jordan. Into the next question, which is what happens when you do go to law school or any other school and you find yourself burdened with huge amounts of debts and, you know, you feel like you don't want to sit in some miserable law job, even if you can get it?
Yes. So last weekend, actually, a culture critic named Lee Siegel wrote a slightly controversial op-ed for The New York Times, in which he recounted his experience going to school and borrowing tons and tons of money to do it, and then realizing that this debt would hamper his ability to live the life of a writer and a man of letters and whatnot. And so rather than accept that and go get a job or try to get a job in finance or law, he decided to default. He just upped and said, I'm going to default on my loans, not pay them back, and figure out how to live my life without much of a credit score. And he has apparently successfully done this. It should be said he didn't just accumulate this debt going to college. He started off at a small private school in the Midwest, apparently, briefly went to state school, but then settled down at Columbia University, where he apparently had a full ride, but was still borrowing, presumably for living costs. And he got not only an undergrad degree, but also a pair of graduate degrees, which, for obvious reasons, a lot of people reacted very poorly to this man's personal story, because he's a relatively well-to-do writer with a nice house in New Jersey who just defaulted on his loans and left the government to pick up the tab. Setting aside his personal story that enraged a lot of people, myself included, I think I called him an unrepentant leech in my in my response, he also said, and this was the bigger problem with the piece, in my opinion, it was like, you too should consider defaulting on your loans, because we need to sort of have an uprising in this country where colleges stop taking students for all they're worth. And the only thing that's going to change it is if the government suddenly has this problem that can't control because everyone's defaulting. And my main objection, and I think a very obvious objection, is that today, if you default on your loans, the government can garnish up to 15% of your wages. If you just sign up for the income-based repayment options they give you, they will make you pay only 10% of your wages every
month.
Okay,
you see, but this is – I find this argument that you're making a little bit confused. Because on the one hand, you are incredibly, you know, sort of...
morally outraged.
Morally outraged,
yeah.
Exactly. You're saying, this is wrong. If you've borrowed money to go to school, you should repay it. And it's you're an unrepentant leech if you don't. And then on the other hand, you're like on the back of an envelope with pencil and paper saying, well, financially speaking, you'd probably be better off if you sign up for IBR rather than if you get this guy and the other.
It's not confused. There are two different issues here.
Okay,
there's
let's just take these issues one at a time.
Number two, regardless of the moral.
So wait, stop. Yeah. Let's take these issues one at a time. Yeah. Instead of trying to conflate them, as you were doing, let's do one first. And let's first start with this idea that there's a moral aspect to debt repayment. You are simply wrong about that. There isn't. It is a financial decision whether or not you make your – whether or not you repay your debts. If you borrow money, you sign a financial contract. If you don't repay those loans – there are financial consequences, and if you can live with those consequences and you think that it's better to do that than to
I totally disagree in this case because student loans are not like other debt. They are subsidized loans from the government, and if you are essentially making a deal with fellow taxpayers, we are making a deal together that this system is going to work together. Otherwise, if everyone does start defaulting, it falls apart, and eventually
whose fault is that, right? I mean, student loans are not like other debt because the government said so. Student loans are also one of the hardest categories of loans to discharge. You can't discharge student loans through bankruptcy absent a showing of undue hardship. So honestly, literally, if I get myself into debt because I buy rims for my car, I can get out of that debt a lot easier than I can get out of debt if I've gotten into debt to try to better myself educationally. That's the immorality.
That's the immorality. Right, and I'm with Ellie on this. The thing which we have to be careful about here is to not just automatically backslide into these silly slippery slope arguments. The idea that, well, if everybody did it, like, you can make any argument.
Let me ask a question. Do you think that paying your taxes is any kind of a moral obligation?
A moral?
Yeah, no, I'm asking you, is there any moral obligation to pay your taxes?
We have a social contract.
I think that's kind of demonstrably different, though, right? Like, the taxes are the price that we pay to live here.
Yeah.
And so I don't like to make financial issues into moral issues, but if you were going to make one a moral issue, taxes is probably as close as I would come because it's our kind of shared American compact to pay these. Student debt of any kind, but especially student debt, that's a usury system that you've entered into from a position of absolutely no power and very little knowledge.
You're borrowing money directly from your fellow taxpayers, and they are giving these loans in the end are
You're not borrowing money directly from your fellow taxpayers, Jordan. That's just factually incorrect. You're borrowing money from student lenders. The student lenders
that program doesn't exist anymore, Felix. That program hasn't existed since 2010. Okay? The FFL – sorry, I'm going to rant for a second here. The program – there has not been student-guaranteed bank lending since basically the Obama administration got rid of it 5 years ago. You have direct lending from the Department of Education. Sorry.
Yes, that is true. Obama killed the Access Group and cut out the middleman, and now the loans come directly from the government. But again, who's borrowing? Here's another aspect to your moral issue, right? Who's getting them? Like, I take out the loan. Do I see any of that money? No, it goes directly to my school. Right, so the government pays the school and then requires me to pay back the government. The taxpayers pay. If you want to have a moral outrage about somebody, how about the school? Why isn't the school on the hook when I don't pay back my debts as opposed to me?
I think there is a part of that. There should be. There's an idea called skin in the game that's actually getting popular now that school should pay some when someone defaults. I think that's a good idea. I think separately, though, if there's a difference between defaulting because you simply cannot pay, like you have. You know, you have financially fallen apart. Your financial life is a wreck. You default because you don't know how to get out of the situation and saying, I want to be a writer. I'm going to just set aside this obligation. And as far as the old lending program went, that was a guarantee to banks. It was still, in the end, the federal government on the hook. The banks made the loans. They made all the profits. And if someone defaulted, the bank paid by the federal government and left the federal government to then go collect.
Okay. So, Ellie. Obviously, Jordan is calling you a moral reprobate.
He is.
Yes.
How, because
to
you,
my face.
Because
this is not
you,
the meanest thing we've ever said to each other. This is
because
like,
you did default on your student loans.
The whole story that we talked about in the last segment, it's not possible if I don't default on my loans. It's just I can't make it work.
And so what Jordan just said is that, you know, you had the ability to pay back your loans, and therefore you did something morally wrong by not staying in your big law job.
Yes. That's what he's saying.
That's what he's saying. Okay.
I disagree.
And now, Jordan, are you really saying that? Are you really saying that Ellie has no right to quit his job because he went to law school?
I think it was morally wrong. Is it the, you know, do I think he's a bad guy? In the scheme of Ellie, am I like, Ellie Mistel is just like that asshole? No. I mean, like, but is he morally? I do think it was morally wrong in that case. Yeah, I think I will say it was. Let me put one. When you were defaulting, it was the payment options and management options were probably not as in terms of IBR and whatnot. What year did you default?
Well, I mean, IBR wouldn't even. I mean, I wasn't going. I was defaulting. I wasn't going to make any
IBR
money.
Being income based
right?
Like, repayment.
Yeah. Right. Sorry, IBR being income based repayment. No, I wasn't defaulting so that I could go have another job and work in the public service. But no, I was defaulting so I could not have a job for a bit while I tried to build skills towards a new job. Right. And I think I'm reluctant to bring this up just because I don't want to shy away from the moral approbation, because it's really important for people who are thinking about this that you understand that you have to deal with the Jordan Weissmans of the world who will call you, who will think less of you if you default. So it's, I think, an important part of the analysis. I don't want to shy away from that. I will say that I didn't actually default on my government loans. I defaulted on my private loans because of the wage garnishment that you mentioned. I didn't want the government coming and taking. Uncle Sam is a problem. And but I didn't not default on my government loans out of moral concerns. I didn't default on my government loans out of fear, right?
Like okay. That. So they successfully scared you into doing the right
which
thing.
Which is the same way I pay my taxes, right? To bring that full circle. So but if you are thinking about defaulting, yeah, you're going to have to understand that you're going to have some moral approbation from other people who, and you know,
misplaced
in fairness,
moral approbation. In fairness, add.
Well, in fairness to Jordan's position, I will say this. Like, one of the only ways these companies can get people to pay back their loans is to make it seem like it's such a bad thing to default, right? Like Al Pacino in The Devil's Advocate says, guilt is like a bag of bricks. All you got to do is put it down. But these companies can't exist if people put them down. So it's not – but anyways, I don't blame Jordan for thinking the way he thinks. Like the system
– because the whole financial services industry has spent the past three decades trying to persuade Jordan that debt is a moral issue.
Well, let me be clear here. I have much less of a problem with someone defaulting on their private loans. They're private loans. You're dealing with a bank. You're not those private loans, I mean, they were semi-private. When they were guaranteed by the government, that is where the issue of your responsibility as a citizen, I think, does come into play. Defaulting on Sally Mae now, that's, I think, a different story. You're just dealing with a bank and they are making a bet. And that is, they're not giving you a subsidized loan in any respect. There is no social compact. I think I think you can draw a clear line there. It just, when you do deal with the fact that now student lending is a government business. That's what changes it.
Can we get to the way that it's also really financially smart to your loans as well? Okay. Because I think that's
This is about private loans again,
right?
Yeah,
but I think as the Siegel piece that we're talking about. Look, I'm trying to remember my interest rate for my government loans. Right now it's like 2.1, 2.4. It's ridiculous, right? Last year I bought a house. I have a mortgage, right? And that money that I'm getting, the usury rate I'm getting charged there is much higher, right? So if I came into $50,000, so I've got about $50,000, $60,000 left of government repayment to make. If I came into $50,000, damn straight, I'd pay it on my house mortgage before I paid a cent to my student loan people, right? And that's not a question of default in this hypothetical that I'm using, but I think it illustrates that in certain situations, if you've got $1 and two people who want it, and a lot of times, the student loans are the last person you should give that dollar to, not the first.
Absolutely.
Personal
financial decisions are all a question of prioritization. And I just don't believe that, you know, student loan debt repayments are as high up the list of priorities as the student lenders, including the government, would really have us believe.
I mean, as a taxpayer.
do you think that they should make it easier for people to discharge their debts through bankruptcy? That's a very simple...
Yes, I do think that once you get to the point where someone is willing to go through bankruptcy, they are willing to go before a judge and say, I cannot pay. There is no hope of me paying. This is, you know, there is no real... I mean...
No, that's not what bankruptcy...
That's undue hardship. That's what it is right now. Just to be clear for the listeners, right? Right now, if you want to discharge your debts, you can only do it through a showing of undue hardship, which means you have to go before the judge and be like, I am so sad and the crack and it hurts and blah, 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 right? Yeah. If it was regular bankruptcy, you could just go and be like, you know what? I'm done.
Regular bankruptcy, all you need to do is say, my assets are lower than my liabilities. That's basically all you need to do.
Yeah, sorry. I went off a little too far there. I would like it if someone is willing to go through bankruptcy, the whole process of bankruptcy. I think that is a different situation. And I do undue hardship. It's basically impossible. I mean, it's damn near impossible to get your loans forgiven under. There are a few instances. Essentially, you have to be sick and dying, or not sick and dying, but just no real hope of working. And that is
drug addiction helps.
Drug addiction does help. No, it's been found. Actually, there was a paper on this. Drug addiction really does help. But there should be a lower standard. Most people who are thinking about maybe defaulting aren't thinking about filing for bankruptcy, because there are also profound consequences when you do file for bankruptcy that last a while.
I don't know if that's true. I think one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is that the people that we're talking about who are making these decisions, we're talking about 22-year-olds. We're talking about an 18-year-old who signed, as Felix is putting it, we're talking about a person who signed a contract when they were 18, had those debts come due when they were 22, 23. I don't know if your average 24-year-old on the street actually knows, oh, I have bankruptcy options and I have this option, I have that option. I think all they know is I can't pay back this money unless I'm willing to do something that I absolutely don't want to do. And so if you're willing to kind of agree that student loans should maybe be able to be discharged through a regular bankruptcy proceeding, then I think we're getting closer to the it's a financial transaction that doesn't have the morality attached to it, and then it's just about getting the information into the hands of the students at risk in trouble who need the information to figure out how to best manage their funds.
Yeah, it seems to me that, as Ellie said, Jordan's painting this as, well, the government, we taxpayers, society are lending you this money at a subsidized rate, and so you owe society on a moral level to pay it back. But really what's happening is that the government is subsidizing insane cost inflation at universities, which we've talked about on this program, you know, many times in the past. And it shouldn't be on these, you know, guileless 18-year-olds to pay for all of that. Like, I think that if they can't pay, or if you're trying to ask them to do something they really don't want to do in order to repay it, then, yeah, there are negative financial consequences to defaulting on your loans. But let's not make this a moral issue.
Look, people do things that they don't want to do all the time because they have to, because they need the money.
Can we go back to the, like, on the other? So we've all stated our positions here. I just want to reemphasize, though, the dollars and cents, the second half of it, which is the way repayment works now. Assuming that you can't figure out a way to stop the government from garnishing your paycheck, there isn't much of a reason to do it, because you can get a lower monthly payment.
But I'm pretty sure that in the case of both Lee Siegel and Ellie Mistel, they did manage to figure out a way of stopping the government from garnishing their paycheck. There are actually quite a lot of ways of doing that. So I'm not sure that's a safe assumption.
Well, you know, you didn't. He didn't.
Well, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't default.
And Lee Siegel, Ellie did it by not defaulting on the government loans, which were, correct me if I'm wrong, a minority of your loans.
I think it was about half.
Yeah.
The rest was through the largesse.
No one is clear on exactly how Lee Siegel avoided having his paycheck garnished. The running theory, because he hasn't elaborated, is because he's basically a freelance writer. And the way they do it is they go to your employer, whoever's issuing your W-2, and they start garnishing from there with tax withholding.
Take out the source.
He doesn't have an employer. He can maybe fall through the cracks there. Assuming that you're not looking to live the life of, like, you know, of a freelance writer in New York, you are probably I've even talked to lawyers about this. 99% chance that you're going to be better off just going for this income-based repayment program. And that's, again, why I find the go default on your loans advice that you gave really, really
okay, so we will talk ill-advised. About, you know, the financial upside and downside of default and bankruptcy and that kind of stuff, and when it's a good time to file for bankruptcy on a different episode, because we've gone way over time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, you know, it's good. Our listeners will forgive us. So very quickly, we are going to run through the numbers round. Ellie, did you bring a number this week?
I did, in fact.
What's your number?
3.4 million.
That's a number of dollars, I'm sure.
It is a number of dollars. It is a number of dollars that Pornhub estimates it will cost to film their first space sex tape. And I think this is very important because I'm big liberal, and so I generally believe that the government should be involved in funding research. But this is an aspect of research that only private industry can do. Look, if we're ever going to get out of off this planet, we're going to need to know how to do this. I'm sure there is some like dark DARPA NASA thing that's already tried this out. But as far but in a public way, we're going to need to know how to continue our species in space, and Pornhub is probably in the best position to do that research for us right now. Yeah, so I'm all for it.
There's going to be like some like 11 – no, not 11. There's going to be like some 14-year-old boy on a flight to Mars at some point in the future, and he's just going to be queuing up this video about like how it works.
But interestingly, Pornhub is not just paying $3.4 million to do this. They're trying to crowdfund it, right?
Because
this is the hilarious thing. Pornhub makes most of its money by pirating porn on the internet. And so they know that if they just fronted the money, they would never be able to make it back. So they're forcing people to pay the money up front to watch this porn up front because they know they're never going to get it once it gets pirated.
I would donate if I wasn't terrified of Pornhub having my credit card.
That's brilliant.
Jordan, are you going to donate to the Pornhub campaign?
I'll contemplate it.
Or you know what? You know what you could do, Jordan? You could just spend a bunch of time on Pornhub watching the Pornhub ads, and that's just a way of implicitly supporting this campaign.
Oh, great.
Are you advocating?
It's a moral good to spend time on Pornhub because we are advancing the cause of the species.
That's
I think I'm going to go back to defaulting on tests.
All right. Was it my turn?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so my number, because we like real estate porn, as Felix has put it on this show, I wanted to direct everyone's attention.
A slightly less explicit form of pornography.
Yes, this is the porno edition of Slate Money. So my number is 40,000, actually more than 40,000, which is how many square feet are apparently going to be in the basement of the most expensive house in London. It's this estate called Wittenhurst that has a long and storied pedigree that has apparently has been purchased by some Russian oligarchs. And there's this wonderful story in the New Yorker by Ed Caesar, just where he tries to track down who actually owns this thing. Because it was a mystery for a very long time, and he comes up with a very convincing theory, at least as someone who's never read about this issue before. I don't want to spoil anything, but if you do like the machinations of Russian oligarchs and expensive real estate, things that we have discussed on this show, I think you'd really enjoy this article. Just to put that 40,000 number in context, though, the largest residential property in Manhattan, according to this article, is only apparently 51,000 square feet. This place's basement is almost that big.
And the largest here's the segue for you. The largest residential property in Manhattan is a townhouse owned by Jeffrey Epstein, who has a thing for underage girls, but that's a whole other thing.
Jesus.
Back to the porn edition.
Okay.
Back to the porn.
Allegedly has a thing for the love of God, libel.
imagine the porn you can get done in a 40,000 square foot basement.
Allegedly.
Who did do time in jail for...
Oh, he did. That's right. Sorry. Yeah. No more allegedly.
And Jeffrey Epstein's brother, Mark Epstein, was the trustee of Cooper Union when it wound up taking on $100 million of debt to build this ridiculous white elephant building, which it could never pay for, and basically in so doing doomed Cooper Union to having to end 175 years of free tuition and have to start charging tuition. And this is one of the great tragedies of higher education in the United States. And happily, Mark Epstein is finally out. As one of the trustees of Cooper Union, he resigned last week along with four of his fellow trustees. So this is my number. My number is six, is the number of resignations we got from the board of Cooper Union last week. I'm very happy about this. There was Mark Epstein, ding dong, which is dead. There is four of his fellow trustees who are all on the side of Jamshed Barucha, the president who introduced tuition and who just completely failed to bring the community of teachers and alumni and students along with him on that. And most importantly, even more importantly than Mark Epstein, Jamshed Barucha himself resigned. So Cooper Union only has an interim president. It's a little bit like Twitter, I guess, in that respect.
That was the most amazing segue I've ever heard. That was,
Thank you. So yeah, my number is six. And with any luck, Cooper Union will be able to get through this. But I'm not holding my breath because it is a very, very, very nasty situation. And financially, they have all of this debt and they can't default on it because it's all secured against basically their endowment, which is the land under the Chrysler Building, and if they lose that, then they lose everything. So that's a positive development in a something which is still a very tragic story. Ellie Mistel, thank you for coming on and being told about your moral failings by Jordan Weissman.
Reprobate.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
We will thank you all, listeners, for listening to this edition of Slate Money, and there will be more, so do subscribe to us. You can find us by searching for Slate Money in the iTunes store. Leave a review there. Write to us. Our email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Stan Alcorn for producing this week, and to Joel Meyer, the managing producer, and to Andy Bowers, the executive producer. Slate Money is part of the Panoply Network, so check all of our shows out. You can find them at itunes.com/panoply, and we'll be back next week on Slate Money.
I'm Matt Zoller-Seitz. Join me, Gazelle Amami, and Margaret Lyons as we talk about Hannibal, Halt and Catch Fire, and whether there is such a thing as too much violence. Subscribe to the Vulture TV podcast at... What was that? Subscribe to the Vulture TV podcast. Okay, subscribe right. to the Vulture TV podcast at...
at your mother.
Like canned peas. You know, get it into control now.
Dead orphans.
Subscribe to the Vulture TV podcast at itunes.com/panoply. We can use that.